You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. If you stay on top of the news, it is easy to get down. We have a deadly pandemic entering its third year, the relentless march of climate change, and what appears to be a slowly decomposing political system that's not really up to dealing with either of those crises. So we thought we might spend some time on the long view, starting with the cosmic debris circling a small star that coalesced into a spheroid object we now call Earth. Our next guest has spent nearly a lifetime exploring rocks around the world, examining microscopic fossils to trace the earliest signs of life, and synthesized a lifetime of insights from that plodding, methodical work into a remarkably accessible book called A Brief History of Earth, 4 Billion Years in 8 Chapters. Its author is paleontologist Andrew Knoll, who is Fisher Professor of Natural History at Harvard, winner of the prestigious International Prize for Biology, and our guest for the hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Why don't you start by telling us what drew you to your field in the first place?
Well, I must admit that when I went to college, I really had no idea what I wanted to do. I was good at math, so I went to engineering school, but being precocious, I knew after a year I didn't want to be an engineer. So I, out of desperation, basically took a whole bunch of math and science courses the beginning of my sophomore year and found, A, that I loved both geology and biology, and B, that despite the way they were taught as separate universes, there were a lot of questions about this planet that require that we see them as two sides of the same coin. And once I had that insight, I was off and I've never looked back.
One of the insights in your book that kind of made my jaw hit the floor is that life would probably not have happened on this planet without plate tectonics, without the dynamics that we mostly experience as earthquakes. Can you take us through that argument?
Yeah, I think it's an open question as to whether life can actually begin in the absence of plate tectonics. But certainly, in some ways, the more remarkable feature about life on Earth is not just that it began long ago, but that it has persisted for 4 billion years. And that very much is related to plate tectonics on our planet. The reason that it's related to that is that plate tectonics provides a way of refreshing the atmosphere, refreshing seawater. So through time, it helps to maintain the types of environments in which life can thrive.
It's not a given that a planet would have continental plates slopping about atop a molten layer of magma.
No, that's right. In fact, in our solar system, Earth seems to be unique. You know, we know a fair amount about both Mars and Venus, two other rocky planets, and they do not seem to have had similar tectonics to what has developed through time on Earth.
So when we think of plate tectonics, it almost always comes up in the context of talking about, you know, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, catastrophic events. Explain how it's stabilizing, how it creates one of the conditions that lets life persist.
Okay, well, let's think about carbon for a second, because carbon is a key element, both because the chemistry of life is largely based on carbon, but also because carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is a major arbiter of climate. So let's start off with some carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and a plant or a microscopic plankton in the ocean takes that carbon dioxide and makes it into organic matter. Now, most of that organic matter will be chomped on by other organisms and returned to the atmosphere as CO2, but some of it gets buried as organic carbon, and that really means there's a net movement of carbon from the atmosphere into sediments. Now, absent something like plate tectonics, that carbon could sit there forever, basically. But because that carbon is on moving plates and on the Earth, eventually it will go back into the mantle. And after that, through time, it will come back to the surface again as carbon dioxide from volcanoes. So in that sense, the volcanoes keep, or plate tectonics keeps the carbon cycle from running down.
So absent those plate tectonics, the emergence of life would extinguish the conditions of life. It would slowly sequester all the carbon and turn the planet into a frozen block of ice.
Well, at the very least, the sort of amount of biological activity on the planet would be very restricted through time. You're right. The system runs down like a watch.
So let's talk about the kind of catastrophic breaks in that cycle. One of the areas that you personally have done really groundbreaking work is what's called the third mass extinction, the end of the Permian period. First of all, what was the biological regime on the planet like before that third mass extinction?
Okay, well, I usually tell my students that they would not have enjoyed a clam bake during the Permian period, because if you looked on the seafloor, there were lots of shelled animals, but most of them were not the clams that we see today. Most of them are brachiopods, which actually have relatively little organic matter making up the organism inside the shell. And then if you wanted to have, your lobster with that, there were no lobsters and shrimp, that basically the major members of their biological group, the arthropods, in the oceans at least, were things called trilobites, which actually have very little muscle mass. So it was there were things like corals, which went extinct. It was at a very broad level recognizable, that is, we can tell the major groups to which the various organisms on the seafloor existed or belonged. But there's a distance there too, because 90% of those species disappeared at the end of the Permian period.
So what happened to trigger that mass extinction?
Yeah, well, that's been a good question for a long time. I mean, if you take an introductory geology class and they show you the geologic time scale, you'll see that the Permian period is the last period in what's called the Paleozoic era, and the succeeding Triassic period begins the Mesozoic era. And those names reflect the fact that the biology of these two time intervals, as judged from fossils, is really very different. And that's been known for, a century and a half or more. More recently, it's become clear that there wasn't a gradual decline in the Permian biota and then a gradual acceleration of evolution within the more modern type organisms. In fact, the boundary between those two is very sharp. And the real punchline comes that we now know that something very unusual happened right at the moment of that boundary. And that was a massive volcanic eruption in what's now Siberia, which basically was a million times larger than anything ever experienced by humans or our immediate ancestors.
Having the effect of what?
Well, that's another interesting question, because probably the first order thing that massive volcanism did was to spew a great deal of carbon dioxide and perhaps other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So what happens with that is the climate got warmer. There was global warming. Some of that carbon dioxide goes into the oceans. So the pH of the oceans drops, what's called ocean acidification. And particularly in deeper water masses in the oceans, the amount of oxygen decreases or even disappears. So in a nutshell, what happened then is very similar to what you're reading about in the newspapers that's going on at this minute.
Let's talk a little bit about how we know what we know. If you were digging through strata of sedimentary rock from that period, what would that mass extinction look like?
Well, I've actually seen the so-called type section of this extinction in China, and it's fairly dramatic. As you sort of climb up through this cliff, it's full of limestones. The limestones are just packed with all sorts of fossils. It's a very rich, luxuriant biota. And then you get to a point at which you could put a knife blade and you never see those organisms again. What you see above that for hundreds of meters of section is rocks that have very few fossils. The fossils that you see have very low diversity. Most of them are very small. So what the extinction actually looks like in the field is just this sudden cessation of what was a thriving, luxuriant biota.
And then how do you tie that extinction to a sudden spike in atmospheric carbon?
There's a number of things that you can do. When we originally hypothesized that carbon dioxide was a possible killer here, we actually went through the route of physiology. It turns out that biologists have been doing experiments on the relationship between elevated carbon dioxide and animals for 100 years. And so a colleague and I literally spent 3 months in the library just saying, what are these experiments like? And what we found is that using a number of criteria that we can actually infer with reasonable confidence from fossils, we could divide the late Permian organisms into two groups, those that we would predict to be more vulnerable to CO2 increase and those that we would predict to be more tolerant of it. And that, you know, division based on physiological experiments actually provides a pretty good first order explanation for what we actually see in the geologic record. So there's that. We also have evidence from the chemistry of sedimentary rocks that there was a very strong warming at this moment in time. And when that happens, the most obvious way that that can happen is to increase CO2 in the atmosphere. And then sometime actually after we published our first paper on this, it was discovered using radiometric dating, that is using the breakdown of radioactive isotopes to date rocks in the field, that at the precise time of the extinctions, we have this massive volcanism, and you can actually estimate how much carbon dioxide would have been spewed by that. So several lines of evidence from physiological to geochemical all come together to paint this picture of rapid environmental change.
So let's focus on the biological. Running into the third mass extinction, like, what are the types of life forms that we expect to be able to weather that sudden spike in atmospheric carbon?
Well, interestingly, to a first order, it's the kind of organisms you see in the oceans today. So at least relative to some of the other animals in the oceans, things like clams and snails, we would expect to do fairly well. If you go down to the beach or the ocean today, you'll find clams and snail shells all over the place. But had you done that in the Permian period, you would have seen a few, but you would have seen a lot more of a group called brachiopods, which still exist, but are a very minor group in the oceans today. Also, one might expect vertebrate animals, fish, to do fairly well. And fish are one of the few groups that actually diversify across this boundary. And in general, things that make massive skeletons with a minimum of kind of physiological ability to modulate the fluids from which they make those skeletons, corals are the best example in today's oceans, those groups of organisms tend to do very poorly. So again, you can say, well, we have corals today, but in fact, all corals in the Paleozoic era went extinct at the end of the Permian, and the corals we have today represent a de novo evolution of skeletonized sea anemones later on as life, you know, rediversified.
So in other words, when conditions are stable enough for long enough, a similar form of life emerges, even if its precursors have been wiped off the face of the planet.
Yeah, so it's not just that the same things will emerge, you know, and the great example of that is actually from another extinction where the dinosaurs got hammered, and the only dinosaurs that reemerged afterward were the birds, but mammals, which had been a minor part of, you know, little organisms that lived in trees and fed at night, they survive relatively well and radiate to form our current mammal-rich environment. So in the case of these corals, it was just that, you know, in a world where there are predators, it pays to have protection. And the kind of skeletons that we see in corals through time are very good anti-predator devices. So in some cases, yes, we see similar things come back. We also see the emergence of some groups that may have existed before, but where minor parts of the biota become major constituents of ecosystems.
Is there a consistent theme across these massively disruptive events? Like, do they inevitably steer life towards more complex forms, like those vertebrate fish that diversify after the third mass extinction?
Well, it turns out that of the five major mass extinctions in the geologic record, there is no common causation. So the phenomenology of each of them is distinct. On the other hand, it is the case that in most of these extinctions, there is a changing of the guard. It isn't necessarily that more complex things are going to take over, but different things do. So if you ask, you know, what were the major drivers on the evolution of animals from the beginning of animals until today, I would say that these extinction events are just as important as the population genetics through that whole interval.
There's been a rash of books written for a popular audience by archaeologists or writers interviewing a lot of archaeologists, and we've interviewed a bunch of them in the past couple of years. And all of that history lives in you know, the past 10 to 30,000 years. You start your history of humanity, of Homo sapiens and its closest relatives, about 2 million years ago. How do our imprints first start on the Earth?
Okay, well, it depends how close an approximation to our own species, Homo sapiens, you're talking about. I would say that both fossil evidence and so-called molecular clock evidence, which comes from the comparison of gene sequences for different organisms, suggests that our lineage, the human lineage, split off from our closest relatives, which are chimpanzees and bonobos, on the order of 6 or 7 million years ago. And about 6 million years ago, we do see in Africa fossils of things that don't, they look almost as much like chimps as they do like humans, but they have certain characteristics in their skeletons that tell us firmly that these are on their way to becoming us. And through time, we see species that become more and more similar to us. They walk upright. They start getting larger skulls for larger brains. Their teeth change, which shows their diets are changing. And the first things that belong to our genus, the genus Homo, are on the order of 2 million years old. And that's not quite us yet, but it's fairly close to us. And the oldest fossils of things that anthropologists would put into our own species, Homo sapiens, are about 300,000 years old, again, coming from Africa.
What kind of an impact do those early humans start to have on the planet that they've emerged on?
Well, they've had an influence on the planet pretty much since they started to exist. Now, early on, the footprint of humans is fairly small. Originally, modern humans were in Africa, and it's only, I would say, on the order of 100,000 years ago that their first tentative steps to go through Eurasia occur. As some of your listeners will know, there were other closely related species in Asia and Europe at the time. Neanderthals are the ones that are best known, but not the only one. And indeed, once Homo sapiens started migrating throughout Eurasia, there's genetic evidence that they interbred with those species. So most of us have a couple percent of Neanderthal genes in our bodies. But something happened, and we don't know quite what, but about 45,000 years ago, more or less, there seems to be this great leap forward. That's when we start seeing painted caves, not only in Europe, but as far away as Indonesia. That's when we first start seeing, you know, beautiful representational art. Humans seem to have much more sophisticated toolkits that are preserved from that time on. They seem to have a better use of fire. And at that point, humans start not only growing in population, but affecting other populations. So there's evidence that human burning has an influence on European vegetation already on that time scale. And perhaps the best example of humans having an effect on other elements of biology is when humans finally came to North America, again, at least 16,000 years ago. But as humans moved through North America and developed new cultures, tool cultures, things like this, they ended up at least being partially responsible for a major extinction of the vertebrates that had lived in North America. That would be, you know, saber-toothed tigers, mammoths. There were camels in North America. So it isn't just modern humans that influenced the planet. Humans have been influencing the rest of our world since day one.
So I engage with climate change on like the timescale of news cycles. And if I cover it for an extended period of time, I experience like a profound sense of existential gloom. And I'm curious how you, having spent a lifetime training your brain to think in much longer spans of time, how you think about, and more importantly, how you feel about the things we are doing to warm the planet up.
Well, I think, yeah, you're right that I commonly think in terms of a planet that has developed over billions of years. But as the examples of mass extinction that we've talked about underscore, there have been short intervals of time in the past where major and generally unpleasant things have happened to the planet and its biota. And in the past, that has been caused by volcanism. In one famous case, a large meteorite hits the Earth. And so in a sense, the geologic record teaches us to be wary of times when Earth's environment changes at a rapid pace. So when I look at my lifetime, what I see is a planet that is changing at a rate that is unusual on a geologic timescale. I see not only global warming, but pollution, many things that humans have done that change the nature of the planet and its habitability for other species. And it, I must say, it makes me wary. Maybe it's too strong to say it fills me with dread, but I do see us driving toward a cliff. And remarkably, I see, particularly in the United States of America, a fair amount of indifference to that. And I think for the sake of our children and grandchildren, it's criminal to have that indifference. There are many things we can do to minimize the effects of global change and the human footprint on the Earth, but we need to have the will to do them.
Before the intervention of advanced human society, the planet was swinging back and forth between two kind of climactic states, glaciated periods, ice ages, and interglacial periods, which is what we would have called roughly the last 10,000 years or so. It doesn't seem like we're headed back into an ice age anytime soon. How do you think about where we are headed?
Well, you're absolutely right, for reasons that have to do with the dynamics of how the Earth circles the sun. Climate does oscillate, and it has oscillated through time. And we see this, as you've noted, fairly dramatically over the last 2 million years, because continental glaciers have, you know, expanded southward from the North Pole, northward from the South Pole. And we have had this rhythmic beat of colder and warmer intervals. It is probably the case that in the absence of humans, we would, on some time scale measurable maybe in thousands of years, find ourselves moving back into an interval of expanded glaciation. But you're absolutely right that the issue now is not will we go back into an ice age, but will a majority of the ice that exists now melt? And that has huge consequences for anyone who lives in Florida or Venice or Bangkok, or for that matter, New York City.
Or anyone who depends on drinking water from high altitude glaciers.
Yes, that's right. There are many millions of people, particularly in the sort of peri-Himalayan area, but other parts of the world too, where the availability of fresh water does come from glacial melt. And it will be several hundred years before that spigot is completely turned off. But there's no question that even on the timescale of decades, that will be a concern to people in many parts of the planet.
Hmm. Andrew Knoll, that's a grim note to end on, but it's a grim world to have the conversation in. I want to thank you so much for the 4 billion year long tour through its history.
Well, thank you. It's just my telling the story of things that have animated me through time in hopes that people will come to appreciate the planet that we live on.
Andrew Knoll is Fisher Professor of Natural History at Harvard, winner of the prestigious International Prize for Biology, and now author of A Brief History of Earth, 4 billion years in 8 chapters.